You can open your Bibles to John 20. We'll start reading in verse 24. I titled the message, Why Do We Doubt? Y'all probably know exactly where I'm reading here in John. Y'all know of a man that is known a lot for his doubting. You all probably already know his name. Anybody want to say it? Thomas. Poor Thomas is still stuck to this day with the stigma of being a doubter. And I just thought I'd share at the beginning of this message, it's maybe poor timing after the ordination last weekend and all that. This message did not come from stem at all from a lack of doubt, me doubting God, what happened last weekend, George is being ordained. That's not where this message came from. It's more of a need in my own life, me doubting myself, me wondering if I have the capability and the confidence of living a Christian life. Can I actually do that? So that's where this message came from. We'll read John 20, 24 through 29. But Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. The other disciples therefore said unto him, We have seen the Lord. But he said unto them, Except I shall see in his hands the prints of his nails, and put my finger into the print of the nail, and thrust my hand into his side, I will not believe. And after 8 days, again, his disciples were within, and Thomas was with them. Then came Jesus, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst of them, and said, Peace be unto you. Then he said to Thomas, Reach hither thy finger, and behold my hands. Reach hither thy hand, and thrust it into my side. And be not faithless, but believing. And Thomas answered and said unto him, My Lord and my God. Jesus saith unto him, Thomas, because thou hast seen me, thou hast believed. Blessed are they which have not seen, yet have believed. So we have here, this is about as much as we read about Thomas in scriptures. There's other times that he's mentioned and he's talked about, and I'll cover a little bit of that later. But this is our perspective of Thomas today. He's known as a doubter. Then his name actually means twin. Literally, he was very likely born a twin. But mostly, we don't think about Thomas being a twin. We think about him being a doubter. We don't read in Luke 11:16. We read of him again, and we're reminded there of his willingness to die with Lazarus. Just let me go and let me die with Lazarus. He was longing for heaven. Maybe I'm not sure what his thought process was there, but we don't remember him much for that. We remember his doubt. So going back to verse 25 and 26, it seems that the disciples, after the crucifixion of Jesus, were meeting together occasionally. Why not? You were all ran in the same group with Jesus, it would just make sense to get together. And we see that Jesus had come and revealed himself to the disciples, but somehow Thomas missed that meeting. For whatever reason, he wasn't there. And we have the disciples telling Thomas, we've seen him. He's alive. We have seen him with our own eyes. He was in this room with us. And Thomas made the declaring statement of he will never believe unless he sees. I have to see it with my own eyes. And he gets that privilege. Can you imagine what it's like to be in a room with all the doors closed and suddenly there's another physical being in the room with you that just, no door opened, all of a sudden it's there. That would be a supernatural feeling. I can only imagine. And verse 27, We have Jesus giving him the opportunity to do exactly what he needed to do to remove all doubt that Jesus was resurrected. Jesus gave him that chance. He gave him the chance to thrust his hand into his side and to feel his scars. And Thomas did. Thomas did. And I believe every person that was ever born on this earth will someday have that opportunity to see those scars. Isn't that amazing? We can see the same thing Thomas seeing. Woe to those who aren't prepared, and what a blessing to those that are. Can you imagine actually seeing that? Someday it'll be reality. It's kind of hard to imagine that right now, but that's the way it will be. And can you imagine the disciples exclaiming to Thomas, "See, we tried to tell you. Do you believe us now?" And we have Thomas saying, "My Lord and my God." He believed. At that point, he believed. And he was completely convinced that Jesus did resurrect from the dead. His doubt was gone. And I believe, from my own personal opinion, from that moment on, and maybe the devil knew he had a weakness in doubting, so it wouldn't surprise me if the devil came back and tried to haunt his feelings and "Are you sure it was actually Jesus?" But I have a feeling Thomas went out of that room convinced for the rest of his life that Jesus had resurrected. I believe he was a convinced man. In verse 29, we have Jesus reprimanding him a little bit. Jesus didn't judge him for his doubt. I don't think doubt's sin, but apparently Jesus wasn't pleased with him. Verse 29, Jesus said, "Thomas, because thou seen me, thou hast believed. Blessed are those that have seen, that have not seen, yet have believed." We don't know much about Thomas from this point on. There's old writings out that and legends. It's hard to know exactly what's true, but it seems he was murdered by a jealous Hindu priest later. But we do know that he was active in church building work from that point forward. He was doing whatever he could, but very likely this stigma followed him all the rest of his life. It's still there today, this fact that he doubted. Now, I like to look at Thomas and say, Thomas, you were there with Jesus personally. You were one of his disciples. You followed him closely, and yet you doubted. But I can't poke fun at, I can't poke nothing at Thomas. I can be the exact same way in my life. I can be just as doubting and guilty of doubting as what Thomas was. I like to think I have complete faith in God, and he has a perfect plan for me and my family. But there's times if I'm very honest, I doubt am I capable of living out this Christian life? Can I really be a husband and a father that glorifies God? Can I really lead my family into an eternity that has heaven on the back of it? Do I have that capabilities? Does God... And before you know it, you start having these doubts in your mind. And we all of us this morning have the complete Bible in front of us. And that's something Thomas didn't have at that time. I can see how salvation played out all the way from Genesis all the way through Revelation. And it's there, it's solid information. It's stuff we've been taught about all our lives, and still I have my doubts at times. Shame on me for being like that. But that's me being human. God loves to see us put our doubts aside and have a childlike faith in him. And one thing Satan loves to do is keep plaguing in our minds. If he can get a little foothold in there and start the doubting process, it can be a downhill spiral fast. He'll make us doubt anything we can. He gets a delight in stirring up these doubtful emotions and then watching us struggle. It's one little foothold he can get started in our lives. And how are we as Christians supposed to handle this? It seems like some people can just go through life and they're very solid where they're at. They're very steady people. They don't struggle with these things. And sometimes it feels like you're on a wagon that struggles by yourself in some of these things. I don't think that's quite the truth. And I know personalities are different, but how do we handle this as Christians? I want to read from Daniel 5. I want you to notice the phrase "dissolve doubts" when we read this. Daniel 5, 13 through 16 is all we'll read here. Well, we may add 17 to that. Then Daniel, this was right after the writing on the wall with Belshazzar, the time that just the hand was writing on the wall. And Daniel was brought in to explain this. So starting in verse 13, then Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king spake and said unto Daniel, art thou that Daniel which art of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom my father brought out of Jewry? And I have heard of thee, that the spirit of the gods is with thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. And now these wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof. But they could not show the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of thee, that thou canst make interpretation and dissolve doubts. And now, if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet, and have a chain of gold about thy neck, and thou shalt be the third ruler in the kingdom. And Daniel answered and said before the king, let thy gifts be to thyself, and give thy rewards to another, yet will I read the writing unto the king, and make known unto him the interpretations thereof. Now I have no doubt Daniel was an intellectually smart man. I feel he probably was he had head knowledge. But what made Daniel so special that he could dissolve doubts in the king's own word? The king had serious doubts about this. If you read the first part of this chapter, he was so afraid with this handwriting on the wall. It says I'm not exactly sure how it was worded, but something about his knees smote. Yeah, verse 6, his knees smote one against another. He was one scared king. To think about how confident he was right before the hand was writing on the wall. But, and I don't believe Belshazzar wanted Daniel for his head knowledge in this situation. He wanted Daniel because of the wisdom Daniel had of God. It wasn't that, somehow Belshazzar knew that was a supernatural event. And I think he had a feeling it had something to do with God. And here we have Daniel with his connection to God, and the king knew he needed to tap into that to get the writing on the wall, what it said. And it seems he kind of skeptically got Daniel. He tried everybody first. He wanted Daniel last. But he did. He followed advice and got Daniel. He offered Daniel riches, big time riches, which Daniel promptly rejected and told the king to keep for himself. And then he proceeded to give Belshazzar some very dismal news about his future. And it's kind of interesting, if you read the finish out the chapter, Belshazzar actually kept his word and gave Daniel everything he promised. The gold chain and the made him the third ruler in the land, the wearing of scarlet, all that, which I guess Belshazzar knew he wasn't going to have it for another 24 hours anyway. He may as well give it away, right? And it happened exactly how Daniel had said. The downfall of the kingdom happened exactly how Daniel said. But Daniel, what I'm getting at is Daniel had a connection to God that could dissolve doubts, not only in his own life, but in other people. And how did he do that? How did he do that? One thing we know about Daniel is he was a very predictable prayer warrior. It's what got him thrown in the lion's den, right? You remember that story. They knew when they could catch him praying to his God. Was that maybe a secret for dissolving doubts? Is that maybe a little key that I miss sometimes when I get doubtful? If my prayer life goes down, how often do my doubts go up? Think about that. Think about that. Prayer does have a way of calming our doubts. It's not like every time I go to God with my doubts and pray about it, God wipes them clean and they're all gone and I have complete trust in Him. That's not really how it works. But it has a way of when you pray to God and you realize there's a higher power that can take care of your problems, it has a way of easing your doubts. It does. Don't underestimate the power of a prayer connection if you struggle with doubts in your lives. There's people I meet and have met that think there's always something out to get them. There's always somebody looking for them behind every bush or behind every whatever. 2 Timothy 1:7 says, God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. And I think if we have that prayer connection with God, it helps so much in our Christian walk. And I know it can be easy to talk about this right now in church. You know, we're all here and we can support each other and work together. In the real life, it's hard. If you're by yourself, and that brings me to my next point, loneliness is not conducive to building courage. There's something about being together with people of like mind that, and if you're a person that maybe you struggle a lot with doubts, find a group of people that you can connect with. Like, that's one of the reasons the church is so important. There's something about getting together with people that think like us. We pray together. We read the Bible together. We have that connection with each other. If I'm out all by myself somewhere, that's where you can start getting into your own head and start having these doubts. That's the way I find it. There's a reason that if folks get caught in a crime or something and they go in for questioning, and it's a group of them or a couple of them, what's the first thing they do? They separate them, and that's for a couple of different reasons. Number one, it tells you if their stories are lining up. And number two, they don't know if the other guy's across the wall squealing on them or saying the truth, and they're left over here and they're going to look foolish. They don't have that. They can't. If you're not together, you can't connect. When we're alone, our reserves tend to break down. And that's nothing to be ashamed of. God created us as people that need each other. So if you struggle in this doubt thing, as I do sometimes, connect with people. It makes a difference. All right, moving on. Different things that we tend to doubt. I already talked some about doubting God and His love for me. We talked about this some earlier today. I forget who it was in Sunday school mentioned it, but the wonder of it all that God created me for a relationship with me, and He knows all my weaknesses and my failures, and He knows these doubts that I have, and yet He still loves me. And I'll add this too. If I am a doubting person sometimes it's due to failure and sin in my life, And that is real doubt that needs to be dealt with. Don't live a life of sin and have doubts in your mind and think that that's the devil putting the doubts in your mind. Sometimes God does put doubts in your mind because I really need to straighten up. But if we are truly seeking to follow God's will and we are to the best of our abilities living our life and our Christian life and we love the Lord with our heart, soul, mind, and strength and our neighbors as ourselves, don't let the devil get in there with doubts. Don't let him do it. Read, if you have doubts about God's love for you, I challenge you to read 1 John. Read the whole book, but especially read the first chapter. 1 John is so plain and easy to understand. Go read 1 John. What about some of us here? Some of y'all are leaders. We're all leaders to a certain extent. Some more than others. Some of us are fathers, some mothers, some of you are older siblings, younger siblings. And I already touched some on this, but the capability of me being a dad to two little boys and leading a household, am I capable of being a husband? And you know what? There's times I completely fail as a dad, as a husband. But I praise God that he doesn't ask for perfection. All he does is ask that I keep trying. And that's all he asks of you as a mother or as a father. Whatever your role of leadership is, strive to learn from your mistakes and move forward. That's all he asks of us. If we had to be perfect, we wouldn't make it. And I'll tell you something else. God doesn't ask you to do anything that you can't do without his help. If God called you this morning to be a father to however many children you have, or a mother, or a older sibling, he will give you the grace and the strength to lead a godly home as a father. He will. He will. Even though we don't always feel like we can. What about businesses? We have several business owners in this congregation, and I'm very grateful for business owners. It helps. I work for a business, and it helps put food on the table in front of my children. But I have heard many times that, and I know it for a fact, that leadership is lonely. You have to make decisions by yourself, and sometimes you're out there by yourself. If God called you to run a business this morning, and it's a God-fearing business, and you're doing the best to serve your customers, He will give you the strength to lead that business and your employees. And God will give you the courage you need to fill that position. God bless you, business owners. And God bless y'all as workers. We need workers too. What about church life? You ever doubted a decision your church has made? Now, we've actually been very blessed in this church. I feel so blessed to be a part of this church because we've had a relatively peaceful church life. But not everybody has had that experience. And I can only imagine if I was in a church that was constantly at odds with each other. We'll just say it that way. I would really struggle with leadership and being able to respect the leadership and doubt that they actually have the good in my mind. And it's so sad when we see that, because people want to be a part of a church that the leaders really care for their spiritual life. And when you see fightings and the church is not getting along, you have to start doubting and wondering if church leadership, do they actually have my best spiritual interests in mind? And that's part of the reason we see such a falling away, I believe, from churches today. People doubt in their mind that church leaders actually care about them. And it's so sad. But I will say this, if you belong to a church that has a track record of collectively getting together and making wise decisions, they may not always be the right decision. It may not always be the way I exactly want it. But as a general rule, if the church gets together on these things and makes decisions that are generally wise, I dare say I'm safer there than venturing out anywhere on my own and thinking I could do better by myself somewhere. That's a dangerous place to go. We need the church. What about decisions I made years ago that still haunt me? Y'all ever have to make decisions like that? Years later, you can't forget about it? I don't know that I have that many of those, but I do know there's people that struggle with decisions they made sometimes decades ago. And that's not there's times to look back and learn from our mistakes. We definitely need to. That's part of growing and getting gaining wisdom and learning. But to dwell in a mistake that I made 10 years ago, I question whether that I actually am trusting God if I struggle with that. There comes a time to just drop it and move on. It was a mistake I made. I learned it. I'm not going to let the devil creep in my mind and doubt my future decisions. Just forget it and move on. And that can be hard to do, especially the bigger mistake, the bigger of a scar it can make. But there comes a time to just lay it down. Don't let the devil take your joy and trade it for a bucket of doubts because of something you did wrong way back then. We people can get so caught up, me included, of the what ifs. What if I'd have done it a little bit different? What if I would have purchased it a little different? What if I would have encouraged somebody in a little different way? And I'm not saying we should never do that. That we definitely need to look in the rearview mirror and correct and do our best to move forward. But there's a reason the windshield's way bigger than the rearview mirror. We're not supposed to drive looking in the rearview mirror. If you made mistakes in your past and you've laid it down, just move forward. I've also heard about, thankfully I've not struggled in this too much, but I have heard of couples that have doubted that they married the right person. Ouch. That's a dangerous spiral to go down. Don't do that if you're a married couple. It's rather interesting that We live in a society that they like to, well, this thing of there's only one mate out there for me. Only one in the entire world, and I have to find that one mate. Let me tell you something, that's a true statement and that's a false statement. And it depends whether you're married or whether you're unmarried. If you're an unmarried person, I dare say that's foolishness. There is more than one person you can marry and be happily married to. But let me tell you something else. If you're a married person, you had better believe that there's only one mate out there for you. That's the way I feel about it. Maybe I'm wrong. You can tell me if I'm wrong. Don't let the devil plague you with the doubts that you married the wrong person. Don't let him do it. All right, moving on. What about doubting our elected leaders? Y'all ever done that? I know I have, and it's to my shame. I say I'm a non-resistant, and we believe non-resistance, we believe non-conformity, we don't vote and all that. But I can still spout my doubt and my unbelief in what the president's doing, what the vice president's doing. If you have any doubts about the leaders God has placed in the land, read Romans 13. Go check out what that says sometimes. And Romans was wrote by a man who was abused by the civil leaders in the land. He was not treated nicely by those people. But he still wrote that we're to honor them. I have that here somewhere. Basically, we're to pay our taxes, we're supposed to fear them, and we're supposed to honor them. And that can be so hard to do because we see them making decisions sometimes that are blatantly against Bible teaching. And So it's easy. We have proof that they're doing the wrong thing, right? Doesn't the Bible say that what they're doing is wrong? You know what? Some of the decisions they're making are blatantly against the Bible. I'm not going to deny that. But I can still honor the position of a president, of a vice president, of a governor, all the way down through, however you want to go, the mayor of your town. Even though they're not perfect, you can still honor their position. And don't doubt that God placed them there for a reason. God placed them there for a reason, and he has a plan. All right, in closing, assurance for God's plan for me. Philippians 1:6, we'll read that. Being confident of this very thing, that he which hath begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. Being confident, the opposite of doubting. And perform means to complete, finish, and accomplish. Confidence is the opposite of doubt. And here we have Paul saying that what God started in us, he's going to finish. Paul is saying he has no doubt that God's grace will carry him and us, whoever, through whatever God's going to take us through. No matter what your doubts are about the future, your doubts about your abilities, God will carry you through until the day of Jesus Christ. So can I actually be as doubtless as Paul that that's the truth? That God actually is going to finish what he started in me? We hear the phrase sometimes, you fake it until you make it. You ever heard that? That may be all right in business life or in some other areas of life, but there is not going to be any fake it till you make it Christians on Judgment Day. Don't think you can fake the Christian life and you're going to get to reap the reward of heaven. But Paul is saying here that he has no doubt that what God started in him, he can finish with God's help. And y'all can have that confidence, and I can have that confidence if we just let God do that for us. Why don't we kneel for prayer?